Hi, I'm Sky Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
We've got Robert Crane.
In 3, 2, 1.
He's a Microsoft MVP, a Microsoft
certified trainer,
an Office 365
specialist, blogger, podcaster, social media enthusiast, and one-of-a-kind speaker who has a gift for explaining tech to the average person so they can understand it.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
There's also myself, Mark Keane. All right, let's move on. I'm the voiceover guy, producer of this podcast, blogger, speaker,
Microsoft
Azure MVP, and an Azure/PowerShell Premier field engineer working for
Microsoft,
helping people with a journey and making sense of Microsoft Azure.
You
are listening to the
Need to Know podcast.
It's your source for the very latest in Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations all about Azure and Office 365.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
Yes, we're back for another Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and joining me on the other side of the microphone is the co-host with the mostest, Mark Keane. Welcome.
Hello, Rob, episode 154, and all the way over here, a long way away, in a place called Bathurst.
What a cool place, I was going to say. You beat me to it. You're not there racing touring cars, are you?
So cool over here.
You're not there racing touring cars, are you?
I went around the racetrack yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
I drove up and went around and did a lap. It was magic. I'll tell you what was so cool about it was the fact that yesterday in Bathurst, and this is at about 8:30 in the morning, there was a huge cloud cover right over Bathurst. There was cloud just covering the whole city. It's like fog, essentially. Thick blanket of fog. And then as I went up the mountain on the racetrack, I came out of the clouds, and it was just magical, beautiful blue skies. And I had that scenery that you see on the TV, you know, when you're watching the race on Channel 7, as the race cars come up through the turns up the mountain. It's exactly what I had in front of me. It was great.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's a bit of a change. What are you up there doing?
I'm on a special project, part of my role at Microsoft, helping a customer with their Azure stuff. So it's a 3-day engagement.
Cool. All right. Well, that's obviously going to keep you occupied and get you deep into the levels there with Azure. So since we're talking about that, and you're deep in there, why don't you give us a bit of news? What's been happening in the Azure world?
Well, I'll just quickly run through the... because I can't really mention the customer's name, but I can mention technologies. Remote desktop servers in Azure. Did you know that you can host your own remote desktop services in Azure on IaaS?
Yep, certainly can. And don't forget, you've also got a PaaS solution, but certainly do it in IaaS, that's for sure.
And the good thing is, as a test environment, there is a JSON template. There's a solution in the marketplace. If you type in RDS in Azure, it'll come up, and it'll actually deploy. It takes about an hour to deploy a full environment, contosto.com, a test environment with a domain controller, 3 session host servers, one connection broker server, and 1 gateway server. See, I know a little bit about RDS now. I didn't know really nothing about it before, but basically the requirement the customer had, because they had over 40, nearly 45 of these session host servers in the back end, which basically served the apps and the desktops to the users. And what was happening is in the daytime they were needed, but then at night they only needed about 3 or 5, not many, just a few to keep the lights on. So they didn't want to run their 40 plus servers 24/7. So they needed a solution to shut them down at night in off-peak and then power them back up during the day. And so basically there's a script that Microsoft's put out on their TechNet site. And if you're interested, I can show you the link. But basically what it does, it gracefully at night time, at off-peak time, say 6 o'clock at night, it sticks servers in drain mode. So then it sends a message to the users. The user then logs off, logs back on again. They log onto a server that is going to be staying on at night time. And gradually, one by one, servers shut down in that process. So yeah, it works quite nicely. All thanks to PowerShell too.
Excellent. All right. Well, you've been busy doing that. I've been busy uploading another course to my academy. I've now got SBS to Azure course there, which will take people from an on-prem legacy environment to Azure, get them up and started. And that's sort of going to be the theme of this podcast once we get through our little newsy bit. So what about some news, Mark? Azure news?
Yeah, well, look, on the theme of IaaS and running things in Azure, the first thing I'll kick off with is the announcement that came through just overnight, the new M series of virtual machines in Azure. Now, take a guess, How many CPUs this baby has?
Oh, I don't know. It's going to have a lot.
Well, let me tell you something. This baby, this server, you can host your own Hyper-V environment on there. So nested virtualization.
Oh, wow.
So it's got 128 CPUs, 3.5 terabytes of RAM. It's massive. And so you can host your own VM. And the demonstration they were doing was the VM hosted on Hyper-V within that virtual server. It was a G5 machine, which is the current fastest machine that Azure has to offer right now. And then on that G5, which is inside Hyper-V, you can run another Hyper-V environment inside of that, and then you can run virtual machines on there. And the demonstration, they had an A7 running, which is a fast A-series. And so in other words, the A7 was a nested virtual machine. It was pretty cool. So yeah, and then they were saying they're encouraging people to go and have a play. Go on, set one of these babies up, an M-series of 3.5 terabytes of RAM. But I'm just thinking, Rob, how much would that cost?
Well, probably $3,000 a minute or something. It wouldn't be cheap, that's for sure.
Oh, probably more than what we get paid.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the way it's going. But it's impressive when you stop and think about the amount of power that one single individual can now get access to, when it comes to running that sort of stuff. Oh, man. That Bitcoin farm would run really well on that.
Yeah, you just like... And I don't think they'd ever find it either, because it's a nested Hyper-V server farm. I mean, by the time they peel down the layers, and don't forget too, with new Windows Server 2016, you can make use of your shielded VMs. And so basically what that means is the VMs running in the Hyper-V environment are shielded, they're encrypted. So even if they do get access to them, good luck. They can't sort of crack into them.
Cool. All right. Well, something from the Office 365 world is that Microsoft has released basically the Office 365 adoption content pack for Power BI. So what this is basically a connection to your analytics in Office 365 that you can get to appear in Power BI. No cost for that. We'll put the link in the show notes, but it allows you to see, for example, how many people are using Skype, how much interactivity you're getting on Yammer, how many files and work's being done in SharePoint. So really cool tool, currently in preview, easy to add into your console, and it basically backends into any of the Office 365 reports you've got, but gives you that low-level control and power that only Power BI can do. So pretty cool tool, and again, recommend that to anybody who's looking to drive more adoption into Office 365.
Cool. So it gives you a nice little overview of usage.
Nice little dashboard, lots and lots of options, lots and lots of widgets and icons you can play around with, but it certainly saves you the trouble of having to go in and pull out the logs at a low level, mm-hmm. and gives you the ability to look at that in one screen and also do the queries which Power BI is renowned for. So again, free option, great thing from Microsoft. Certainly recommend people put that in, and we'll put the link in the show notes.
The good thing about it is those pretty graphs that Power BI put out, the people that like them are all the finance people. So, in other words,
the bills.
Finance porn is what it is.
Yeah, that's a good description. It does work like that. And I always recommend that if you are showing Office 365, you do finish off with Power BI because it has a major impact. But it certainly makes life a lot easier. Great thing about Power BI is that the entry-level plan is free, so there's nothing stopping you from diving in, having a play with it.
Okay. My side, Azure Container Registry is now generally available. So same as a Windows registry for containers instead. Stateful place it is to store your information, as containers will run all over the place in multiple environments. They need a registry just like Windows. Now they have one, and more information in that in the show notes.
Cool. All right. Another one here is Microsoft has released a Planner app for iOS. So Office 365 includes a service called Planner, which is a bit like Trello, allows you to manage tasks and to move items from different resources, nice and easy to use, integrated when you get a team, also integrated when you create an Office 365 group. One of the things that has been missing is a mobile app, but Microsoft have released one for iOS. So if you go to the iTunes store, you can download that, put that on your iOS device, connect it up to your existing plans, and away you go.
It's not there. I just went to the App Store, typed in Planner, and nothing.
Gee, I wonder if somebody wrote about it on a blog that also happens to have a link there. So that's probably the place to go, and we'll put the link in the show notes there. So what
is it officially released?
Yeah, it's officially released. Yeah, definitely there. I've got it on my, looking at it on my device here. It's definitely there.
Maybe Apple's taking their time to approve it on their side, which they can do.
Well, maybe because it's geolocated and it's locked out of Bathurst, perhaps, for the time being.
Yeah, maybe because it's too cold. It just hasn't made its way through the telephone wires or the internet cables.
Exactly. They're frozen. There's ice between Sydney and Bathurst. All right, what else in Azure?
Hey, that's an idea. Fibre works with glass. I wonder if you could put ice inside the cable. Would that work quite well too? Have to test it. Azure enables cutting-edge virtual apps, desktops, and workstations with NVIDIA Grid. So last year, we released Azure's first GPU offerings targeting high-end graphics applications. NV-based instances are powered by the NVIDIA Grid virtualization platform with NVIDIA Tesla M60 GPUs that provide 2048 CUDA cores per GPU and 8 gigabytes of GDDR5 memory per GPU. These instances provide over 2x performance increase in graphics accelerated applications as compared to the previous generations. If your organization has a need to run virtual apps or virtual desktops, as we're talking before about remote desktop services, using solutions like RDS, Citrix XenUp Essentials, or VMware Horizon or Workspot, you're now able to run up to 25 concurrent remote desktop session hosts per users per GPU. So office workers and professionals who don't require Quattro optimized applications can finally enjoy virtual desktops with a high quality user experience that's optimized for productivity and pretty much any application you can poke a stick at. It's all the performance of a say a physical PC, the display and everything else. It's pretty much where and when you need it. It's all in the cloud. It's all backed up. You can now dramatically lower your IT operational expense, or OPEX for short, and focus on managing the users instead of PCs. Fantastic. That is definitely the way the world is going. Cloud, cloud, cloud. Azure is the future, baby.
So one of the things that has happened since we've been, since the last episode, is Microsoft had its SharePoint virtual event and it announced the future and more things coming to SharePoint. They had this last year. In this event, they talked a lot, obviously, about the new OneDrive capability coming around with the placeholders style environment, which they call OneDrive On Demand.
Where is that? The fall creators update. Come on, hurry up.
They've also talked about the other features they're going to bring to SharePoint. So what they're going to do, for example, is they're going to allow you to take Power Apps. So Power Apps was the way, I suppose, the replacement for InfoPath, the way to do forms in SharePoint. Now, what they're allowing you to do with Power Apps is now embed Power App forms into the SharePoint team site. Now, previously, Power Apps was only available via a mobile app. Now, they're going to give you the ability to embed, create a Power App to capture information, and then that will be then displayed directly on the SharePoint site and allow you to then back end that directly into the SharePoint list or library or whatever else. So, again, they giving that functionality, which is being asked quite a lot, I think, by people when it comes to SharePoint. The other thing that they also announced is a new template, I suppose. It's called a communication site. So SharePoint is probably defined in two ways. You either have a site that is collaboration, people adding, entering, updating information, or you have a site that pushes information out to people. People read like a traditional intranet. So they have released a new template called Communication Site, which basically is aimed at publishing content out to your users to make it much easier and much quicker to create intranet-style environments for your...
Is that like a blog?
No, it's a bit more than that. So typically what you have when you... people want an intranet, inverted commas, traditional intranet. Typically, it's a publishing site, so they want to post news, they want to post photos, project details, and they want users to come and view that and basically make sure that they're up to date. So, again,
similar to WordPress or something.
Yeah, to an extent. And again, I think it's one of the requirements people have is to be able to publish it out easily. Now, SharePoint interface has changed, made it nice and easy. It's now responsive design. So again, I think they're moving down ability to allow people to create these sort of, you know, WordPress published websites much easier.
So one of these days, it'll be SharePoint owns Facebook is run on 27% of the web.
Well, I don't think it's probably not going to come to the public web, but certainly internally, it's certainly very large, I would think.
Okay, my side, sneak peek, PowerShell. Oh, yes, in the Azure Cloud Shell. Good old PowerShell. So at Build 2017, which happened just recently, we announced the preview of the Azure Cloud Shell, which supports the Bash Shell. It's showcased at exactly, in case you're interested, 9:35 into it. Corey Sanders, he announced it, that we're adding PowerShell support for Azure Cloud Shell, which gives you a choice of a shell to get work done, so straight through the portal itself. The PowerShell experience will provide the same benefits as the Bash Shell and Azure Cloud Shell. You can get authenticated shell access to Azure from virtually anywhere, use common tools and programming languages in a shell that's updated and maintained by Microsoft, and persist your files across sessions using Azure File Storage. Additionally, the PowerShell experience will provide Azure namespace capability to let you easily discover and navigate all Azure resources. I can't wait for that. It also has an interaction with VMs to enable seamless management into the guest VMs, and extensible model to import additional commandlets, and ability to run any executable. So you can sign up today if you want to participate in the limited preview of PowerShell running in Azure Cloud Shell. I've signed up, got access to it. It is magical. We'll put more info of this in the show notes.
And is that pure PowerShell, or is it some like the CLI?
Oh yeah, pure PowerShell.
It's pretty impressive. All right. Yep. So what else have we got on Office 365 news? I think that there are a few things. I think actually there's something here on Azure that I've been very excited about, Mark, that you haven't mentioned yet. Have you got that on your notes to mention something?
Possibly. Depends what it is.
Possibly. What about recovery vaults? You got anything on your list there to talk about recovery vaults?
Yeah, okay. All right. You can talk about that.
Oh, thank God for this. Microsoft have announced the ability to upgrade classic backup vaults to, which means that if you've been doing backups,
this is exactly what you were asking for a long time ago.
Yeah, they've been someone's listening to the podcast. So
funny that.
Basically, if you have recovery vaults which you've created in the older Azure model, Service Manager module, and you wanted to move them to ARM, the only way that you could do it was to basically create a new vault in Resource Manager and then start again. Downside to that was you'd lose basically all your, not lose, well, you wouldn't be able to, you'd have to have a separate container in which you had your previous backups. But Microsoft now have given us the ability, or now providing the ability, to move from the classic backup to the recovery, and I've certainly signed up for that, and hopefully getting them to move that across from me so I can continue to back up my machines into Recovery Vault. So very happy little munchkin over here about that ability being added.
Oh, yeah, you were like saying to me all the time, like, when's this going to happen? When's this going to happen?
Yeah, so, there's that one and a couple others that I'm really waiting for. Directory services in Resource Manager would also be handy, but I'll take the backup one at this stage.
That's right. Because I started at Microsoft 3 weeks ago, that's the power of what I can do.
Excellent.
I just ran into the right person in the kitchen when I was making a coffee, and I said, hey, this is what you got to do. You have to do it because you really have to. And they went back to Redmond and said, look, move that to the top of the list for this guy, Robert Crane. And they did that and they put it out for you.
All right. Well, next time you see the person that's involved in directory services, get them to put that into ARM as well for me, please.
Yeah. Okay. No worries. Okay. And then another one on my side, Azure networking new features. So basically there's a YouTube video with... it's been released from Channel 9. It's on. There's a link in that in my blog. We'll put it in the show notes as well. But basically, the highlight from that, they're talking about packet capture. So you can select a virtual machine in your subscription, choose to store the packets captured, the network packets captured, in either a storage account or file. So storage account's probably the best one there. And then you can run a trace. Now, once you stop the trace, it generates a PCAP file. And PCAP file, you've probably used this in the past, but yes, it is a Wireshark file, and you can now get full visibility of your network in Azure, because what you do, you take that PCAP file, download it from the portal direct, you don't have to use PowerShell or anything like that, and you simply double click on it if you've got Wireshark installed, and you get all the information, all that data right in front of you in Wireshark, exactly what is happening inside of the virtual network in Azure. So they've really opened that up, because previously, Rob, they had no visibility like this for any log files or anything. It was like you're going in blind, and you are using a virtual network. You do have full control over it, but you sort of don't have any visibility as to what's going on behind the scenes, and now you do.
Cool. All right. Okay, so some more Office 365 stuff here. So basically what Microsoft have announced is that Microsoft Planner is now supported in Flow, and there is also now a Power Apps community app. So basically what that means is Flow is Microsoft's automation engine for Office 365, allowing you to connect to different apps and then have automation tasks generated or executed across those services. They could connect to things like your email, to SharePoint, to OneDrive, but also third-party apps like Twitter, Facebook, and whatnot. And now that Flow now supports ability to connect to Planner. So maybe you could set up a flow so that when a task is completed, it kicks off an email or does a notification to you. So that's pretty cool. And again, the Power Apps community plan. So that's obviously focused at people, allowing them to create Power Apps without the necessity to have an Office 365 license. So again, we'll put the information in the show notes, but again, lots and lots more stuff coming to Microsoft over time. So I do have another Azure one. If you've got something about Azure data centers in there, young Mark?
Always. 40 has been announced at the moment. You mean the ones in South Africa?
That's the one.
All right, off you go. Hang on, let me test my knowledge. One's in Cape Town, the other one's in, can't remember.
Johannesburg,
that's it.
So yeah, Microsoft,
opening next year.
Yeah, Microsoft's bringing data centers to the African continent. They're the first providers to put data centers in that continent. So very interesting that we're getting data centers into these sort of regions. Obviously there's demand for them there. We're seeing them pop up all around the place. So there's probably a fair bit of space there to put a data center, but again, Microsoft being able to enable customers there to have a local set of data centers, which is pretty cool. And again, adding more data centers to the Microsoft footprint worldwide. No doubt it will be followed by AWS and probably Google. So we're getting to a point now where there's just going to be a data center around the corner.
Do you think... No, I've got a better idea. You know how I talked about before nested virtualization?
Mm-hmm.
With these new M series of virtual machines that have 128 CPUs and 3.5 terabytes of RAM, what's going to happen is, this is my assumption, is, yeah, Microsoft's got more data centers than both Google and AWS combined. And what they're going to do is, now they've got these M series on offer, they're going to rent them out or lease them out to people like AWS. And they'll have their own nested virtualization hosted in Azure. So you wait 2 years' time, we'll have a news article. AWS is now hosted in Azure. We won! Ha ha!
Well, exactly. It's very interesting, isn't it? But you think about, I mean, if you've seen some photos of even the Microsoft data centers, how they're expanding them, where the size of them is just ginormous. So
yeah,
it's very interesting in a relatively short period of time how quickly these things have gone up and what computing they're servicing. And again, if you're not taking advantage of them, you're really losing out, because, like I said, you know, the power and the ease and the scriptability of it is just amazing. And I think, again, that's why we would recommend the Microsoft Cloud, I think, because, again, that integration also is a major effect when you also roll into it something like Office 365. So, again, I think Microsoft's on certainly a tear with this, and it's obviously being reflected in its revenue figures. So all's good, I would say, there in the Microsoft Cloud. And again, probably the place to go and work for, wouldn't you say, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Hey, the other thing is the data centers opening up in South Africa. Do you think security would be a challenge for those data centers?
No, I think that, like anything, they take normal risks and you know, assessments. And again, they've got the standard. I think Microsoft have been building data centers for a long time, so they've got it down pat, you know.
Mm.
They would have, you know, guards, they would have fences, they would have all the protection. But again, it's like, you know, any place in the world, you know, can have geopolitical issues. But I think, again, when you look at the sovereignty of it, I suppose the way they protect the data, again, you know, I'm pretty sure they've looked at those sort of things. And I think you've got to balance it up against the risk and obviously the customers who want to access it. But yeah, look, potentially, I mean, one of the I suppose one of the things I heard once was that there are ex-World War II gun platforms that sit between England and France, and basically they're talking about putting data centers in those turrets because they were sort of in international waters and weren't under any jurisdiction and difficult to get to. So I think there's a whole science around building really secure data centers.
Yeah, and yeah, you're right. Microsoft would have a down pat for sure, 100%. And their PUE is?
Tell me.
Power usage effectiveness is 1.1 or 1 to 1 or something. In other words, the current standard in the market is 1 to 5 or 1 to 8 or something. It basically means power generated versus power consumed. If it's 1 to 1 or 1 to 2, which Microsoft's got, it pretty much means that there's no power wasted. All the power generated is what's consumed at that level. So the ratio is pretty much like for like. Whereas a lot of the other public cloud providers are much higher. So they're generating whatever electricity they're generating, they're not using all of it. And so some of it goes to waste. It's not good for the environment. So Microsoft's got that down pat.
All right. So before we get into our main subject matter, any more Azure stuff you've got there?
Azure.
Any more news for the ladies and gentlemen? And Azure boys again. And girls?
And Azure again. So, yeah. No, nothing. No more news.
Cool. All right. Well, again, we'll put
just
all...
that.
Go on.
You can pronounce it two ways, too, if you want. You can go Azure or Azure. It doesn't really matter. It's still the same thing.
That's right. Spelt the same way, just a different pronunciation of the vowel. All right. So, yep. We'll put the link to all these items in the show notes for people. And remember... to provide feedback, to let us know what you think of the episodes, and to go and rate us on something like iTunes. Much appreciated for those that have done that. Now, let's...
Oh, wait, one thing.
Yep.
Azure. No, hang on. Seriously. Rode. Thank you very much, Rode Microphones. I'm here in the middle of nowhere, -4 degrees in Bathurst, outside the pool is frozen. It's so cold, it's frozen the flame in my cigarette lighter. It is that cold here. Now, Rode Microphones, I couldn't have done this without you. So thank you, Rode, and thank you, Zencaster, for helping with this podcast.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, they've provided some great support there. We do appreciate it. Made podcasting much easier and made sure that Mark's every sniffle is hearable directly across here on the internet.
Oh, you can hear that. Okay. So we can... So basically, thanks to Rode, we can do podcasts from literally anywhere, any location.
And we certainly do. All right, so in line with the new SBS2 Azure course that I've made available, what I thought we'd run through is maybe over a couple of sessions we talk about migrating a legacy on-prem environment to something like Azure. So for that, we need an Azure expert, which we currently have on hand, luckily. And let's propose some options here, see what he thinks, and discuss those through. So let's set the stage here. So let's say that we have at this stage an SBS server and which also has a member server. So we've got two servers on-prem. The SBS box is a domain controller, Exchange server, SharePoint server, has files and folders, print, all that sort of stuff, right? So we want to move that potentially to a complete cloud environment, get rid of our on-prem, have as little impact with on-prem as possible. And we're going to select to use something like Azure and Office 365 to do that. So what we want to do is, again, take that environment, connect it to Azure, and then move the workloads across to either Azure directly or Office 365. So with that sort of environment that we're looking to migrate from, where should we start, Mark? What should we be doing first, do you think?
Lowest hanging fruit would be Exchange, Office 365. So the easiest win and the safest migration is moving your Exchange mailboxes. Actually, before that, you'd do the identity part, which is AD Connect. You'd get the identities up to Azure AD. And
the first big one would be the Exchange mailboxes. It's not that simple, right? Because let's take Azure AD. Where do you install Azure AD Connect?
Oh, well, anyway, on the whichever. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but you can't on it. Exactly. In a small business server environment, Azure AD Connect, the synchronization tool, is not supported. Even though it's supported on domain controller, they specifically call out small business server that you can't put Azure AD Connect on. So let's take it back a step. Let's say we've got a single SBS box in an environment Again, how are we going to do that? And I think that we've got to look at this, I think, in the overall picture, right? So I would suggest to you that, yes, I agree, Office 365 is where the workload for Exchange is going to go, and that is one of the lowest hanging fruit that we can go. But I would suggest that it's probably a better bet to create a site-to-site VPN to Azure to give you the flexibility that then you have the ability to move IaaS, you then have the ability to connect to Office 365. So I would suggest to you that a site-to-site VPN in Azure would be the first thing you would do.
Well, I was going to say you've got a file and print server, don't you?
That's right.
You said before, so we could put AD Connect on that.
Yes, you certainly could, but let's just say you don't want to impact that. Let's just say that, again, we want to have the scenario maybe where there's only one server. Yes, you could put Azure AD Connect on it, but wouldn't you think that doing a site-to-site VPN and then opening up all the opportunities that Azure provides would be a better way to go?
Yeah, so that would be probably my number three step. So the first step would be AD Connect. So I put that on because you don't need a site-to-site VPN for AD Connect. You can stick that on the file and print, get your identities up there as number one, because that's the very first. Identity is the most important. And then you can migrate your mailboxes second without a VPN, and then you can make use of Office 365 without a VPN and stuff like that. Then any other service on-prem which is SaaS, which can run as a SaaS solution, you can also move them next. So focus on SaaS first before then moving stuff like your IaaS workloads. And if you move your IaaS workloads last, you'd need the VPN as a prerequisite for that. So you'd go AD Connect first on file and print, and you do all your SaaS stuff first, like Exchange, any SharePoint stuff. You'd set that up and migrate all that up to Office 365. Then you'd set up your VPN tunnel. I mean, there's nothing stopping you setting up the VPN tunnel first, but you don't really need it. Set up your VPN tunnel after all that SaaS stuff is gone.
Yeah, but I think the site-to-site VPN, if you set that up, that means that you're going to be able to put in a member server in Azure that you can connect to your on-prem environment. You can put the Azure AD Connect in that. You've already got redundancy. Then you can move the member server from on-prem into Azure IaaS, and then that's off the local environment, and then you can start doing all that other stuff.
So what's this member server doing?
I mean, so typically the member server is going to be running RDS. So again, you probably don't want to have Azure AD Connect on an RDS box, do you?
Okay, so then the components on the SBS server is Exchange, SharePoint, you've got a file and print server, you've got a domain controller,
and also typically you've got the member server is an RDS box, right? So 25 to 75 users. So I don't think you want Azure AD Connect on a member server that's running RDS.
Okay, question for you. With this SBS server running at this business, do they want to keep a domain, like a AD domain, at the business?
So this is, again, a very interesting question, right? So let's assume, for the time being, is that down the track, yes, we want to upgrade and make everything, say, Windows 10, which we can do in Azure Join, Azure AD Join Direct. But let's say, for the time being, we're stuck, or we're still with Windows 7, Windows 8, and maybe one or two Windows 10. So at this stage, yes, we're going to have to keep a traditional AD domain to allow those domain joins. Plus, we need group policy. Plus, we need some of maybe the third-party apps still require this. Okay, so again, at this stage, yes, we're going to have to keep the domain.
Okay, so let me ask you another question. If you set up the VPN tunnel, where are you going to terminate it on-premise?
This is a very good question. This is what we're coming to. So at this stage, again, you want to have minimal impact on the SBS box. The most rational thing to do is obviously to have a router at the boundary that supports a site-to-site connection to Azure via the VPN. But typically what we see in these smaller environments are consumer-grade routers. So consumer-grade routers obviously probably won't do a good job when it comes to site-to-site VPNs, and they won't have the required buffers and struggle. So let's say, again, the best option is to put in a business-grade firewall that has a site-to-site capability and that works with Azure. That's pretty easy. But what's another way that you can terminate it? What's another way that you could potentially terminate a VPN on-prem with, I suppose, minimal impact?
Well, see, the thing is, if they're in that that frame of mind of moving stuff to the cloud, they don't probably want to buy any more equipment on prem.
True. Like now, but don't forget, is also
router.
True. But what I think is, you could put in something like a Windows Server 2016 trial version, which
RAS
I think is
box.
Basically a RAS box. So, again, what you can do is you could plonk that in for, say, 6 months, which under the trial environment, I think they're, you know, a small...
Where would you put that, though?
Sorry? So, again, part of that is you can rejig your network, but what you can do is basically, let's say that you have a SBS server which is connected to a consumer-grade router, which is 192.168.0 whatever. So what you can do is you could move the SBS box to another... IP address range, so 10.0.0.1, put the RAS box in between it and the consumer grade router, and then you could set up the routing path so that you could route across that.
Okay, is the RAS box going to be physical or virtual?
Well, I think that in this case it's probably going to be physical, but there could be, again, this is the advantage you could have.
So you'd have to have another, you'd have to spend more money and get another server.
Potentially,
as well.
But let's just say the virtual, let's just say the SBS box and the terminal server are virtualized, and there is room for another virtual machine, a very small RAS box, so you don't need a lot of RAM because it's effectively acting as a router, so we don't need additional hardware. We can basically run up a virtual environment.
You know what? A RAS box needs two NICs, right? Because it's got an external, it's doing the routing, it's got an internal NIC. Yeah, so you could get away with one of those tiny little computers, like about $400. You just need... but then you need a license for... But you're saying...
Yeah, but if you put a trial version on, you'll get a trial version for a couple of months. So again,
180 days
or
something,
isn't it? Yeah, and again, I think the Windows Server license is that expensive, and you could recycle it down the track. But again, if you've got a virtual environment, you can certainly do it on Hyper-V. You set up, you know, the NIC to do all that sort of stuff. So...
Okay. All right. So then you've got the 180 days for the evaluation.
Yep.
But then... In that 180 days, you've got to like be committed to say, all right, we're going to remove all of our on-prem domain controllers, and we're going to use exclusively Azure AD for authentication to everything.
Yep, you can certainly do that. I mean, that's the aim, and I think, you know, 180 days is you know, a fair whack of time, because obviously let's say that the driver behind this is that the hardware, the old hardware that's running SBS or whatever, is failing, and again, they don't want to necessarily shell out for a huge SBS box with RAID and all this sort of stuff.
And you can do that too, because there was a company I used to work for not that long ago who was a proper company, and it was running a business, making money like other companies, and they were running... They had no servers on-prem. They had everything running in the cloud. So Azure AD, authentication to all the Office 365 endpoints or into Azure. But other than that, with the devices, they just handed out Surface devices and just log in locally with Windows Hello or something else, and you jump into the local machine. But then if you wanted to access, say, anything like any files, SharePoint Online or the email was Exchange Online, stuff like that. So you can happily have a workplace running in that scenario.
Yeah, so that's like what we're that's what we're aiming for. So I think that, to me, it makes more sense, especially when you want to shift the infrastructure is the problem. You know, the infrastructure is old and it's failing. You want to make sure that you've got that flexibility. If you put in a connection to Azure via site to site, immediately you've got that ability. So let's say that untoward the SBS server has a problem that can't be fixed. Well, then you're already in Azure. You've already got the site to site VPN. You can move things much quicker, right? So I agree that moving Exchange first certainly is an option. But I would also suggest that maybe setting up the site-to-site VPN is going to give you that flexibility in that base anyway, so it's worth doing. And again, you can do that with relatively minimal cost. So the trick to it is to, when you want to do that, you want to get an Office 365 subscription first and add the paid Azure subscription into Office 365, so all your identities are together in one tenant. So the cheapest way you can get Office 365 basically is a kiosk license for a couple of bucks. So you can get just a Office 365 tenant with a kiosk license for a few bucks, and then you add an Azure subscription into that same environment. So now you've got access to Azure. Now, the good thing about Azure billing is what, Mark? What's the good thing about Azure billing?
The good thing about Azure billing is... Can I just quickly mention something else?
Well, hang on. Let's just finish this thought. So the benefit of Azure billing is that it's consumption based, right? So if you put in a site to site VPN, how much does a VPN gateway cost in Azure?
Oh, it's quite a bit.
No, it's not. Just the gateway itself is only about $20 or $30, right? If there's no bandwidth going across it, it's a pretty small cost. And again, you only pay for what you use in Azure. So putting in a $3 Office 365 tenant with an Azure subscription, I don't think it's going to cost you a lot. But anyway, what was your thought there?
Listen, if you're going to go down the route and buy a cheapy computer to put a 180-day version of RAS in, because eventually going to get rid of the SBS altogether, you may as well just install the RAS role on the file and print server, and just because that's virtual, I'm guessing, on the SBS server.
But would you put the RAS role on a box that also has terminal server?
See, I don't really understand SBS. So one of the boxes you could put RAS on, couldn't you? Not the domain controller, but
you
put it on another box.
No, you can't put it on the domain controller, that's for sure. So rule that we're not going to touch. We don't want to touch that. But let's say the member server has terminal server on it, right? And it may not have two network cards in it already, right? So I don't think you want to put RAS on a terminal server because you want the terminal server, obviously, to function as reliably. And
fair point.
The other thing is, let's assume that the RDS box also is on its way out. So, yeah, you could do what you're talking about, but there are lots of options here and you have to tee it up. But I think that if we want a reliable solution, it's probably a better idea to look at putting a... And again, you don't need a huge box. So what sort of RAM do you think you would need to run an RS box? You know, just a very simple RS box. You don't need huge amounts of RAM.
For SBS, for a small bit, probably like 4 gigs.
Yeah, exactly. So a 4 gig simple machine with one disk basically functioning as a router, I don't think is going to be particularly expensive. So it's either that, that's one option, or you get a commercial grade router. So in the long run, yes, you probably want a more upmarket firewall to do these connections, to provide better protection, all that sort of stuff. But another option is a very simple RAS box, and a way to reduce the cost, at least for 6 months, is to get a demo version of Windows Server 2016, put that on the box, and again, that'll give you a 6 month window to look at migrating a lot of that stuff across.
Yep, okay, so in a nutshell, identities, SaaS stuff next, VPN, and then whatever you need to move into Azure for the IaaS stuff, any legacy applications or anything else.
All right, so let's run through, how do we set up a site-to-site VPN? What do we need to do in the Azure side?
Well, assuming it's ARM, you just go to the Azure portal. You basically set up your VNet, have all your correct subnets set up, your rest space, so work that out, how many subnets you need. If you want to talk about or work out security, work out whether you're going to have NSGs between them all, and also any user-defined routes and all of that sort of jazz. And then you would then go around the motions, install the VNet gateway resource, and set that up in Azure, and that takes probably about half an hour to go through to come alive.
All right, so the first
and
thing we do...
And then you get the script.
The first thing we do is we need to set up a VNet, obviously. So we put a VNet with the IP address, which is not the same as the one on-prem. And then what we need to do inside that VNet is create a subnet at least for our servers.
Gateway subnet, which is a /28.
And then probably...
Oh, for the servers, yeah. Okay.
And then a second subnet for our gateway, which only needs to be relatively small, so it can be as much as /29.
Yep.
Then that makes sure that all that VNet's running, and then basically I would suggest that you run up a virtual machine in the VNet, so you've got something running, you can ping and you can test the connectivity, and then you set up a virtual network gateway into basically that VNet. Now, as Mark says, running that up, you'll have to put in the IP addresses and that sort of stuff, and it will take probably 30 to 40 odd minutes for that to spin up.
Provision.
So that's basically spinning up like an RAS box in Azure.
In Azure.
Correct. Yep. And then you obviously need to get the secret, the shared secret between the two, set up the site-to-site VPN, which is pretty easy to do on an RAS box on-prem. So then once you've got the site-to-site VPN, you've got that working, right? So now we've got, say, an SBS server, domain controller, and an RDS box on-prem connected via a site-to-site VPN to Azure, which has also got an Office 365 environment there as well. What's the next thing you do, you reckon?
you would possibly, mind blank, you would probably set the VPN up, you would test it.
Yeah, obviously you'd test it, but how about, what about this? What about if that member server you spun up, right, you then join to the on-prem environment, right, not via a normal network connection, so that then comes up as a member server, okay, on the network, and then on that new clean member server, you put Azure AD Connect, you do the connectivity to Azure, and you do
right,
the
synchronization. Right, okay, that's what you mean. You want to do it that way? Yeah, you could do.
Nothing wrong
but
with that.
But then you're only going to need... Yeah, no, it'll work, but then you're basically paying a charge for the VM to run AD Connect for.
Sure, but the idea then is now you've got a brand new machine running in Azure, clean install with Azure AD Connect, and if you want, you can now move some file shares across. You can now move some data. You could also use that machine potentially to install Azure backup on, so you could use Azure backup for files, you could use Azure backup for applications to target the SBS and the on-prem resources. Gives you a nice clean server to do that, and then now that you've got this environment, you can start building out, you know, additional member servers. So then once you've got...
I like the first option for better.
Yeah, okay. It's certainly an option, but let's say again, one of the requirements is we want to give us the flexibility when it comes to hardware. Our hardware on-prem is not particularly reliable, and what we want to do is make sure that we have at least the ease if we need to spin up the IaaS.
But you're building stuff that in Azure, in new stuff, which you're going to end up ditching anyway. So you might as well, like, if you're going to ditch the server in SBS, you might as well build the stuff you're going to ditch on that server anyway. Not use a VPN yet, because you're going to start paying for traffic across the tunnel. So just use the internet to sync all your users up to Azure AD, do it that way, and then move all your SaaS stuff, and then whatever's left, just that stuff, whatever's left that you can't get rid of, then put that in Azure. I just think it's pointless having stuff you're going to get rid of anyway, eventually, because moving down the track, AD Connect will be gone, because you'll be having all your identities in Azure AD, and you're not going to have any domain.
Yeah, down the tracker, but this track may be, you know, a couple of months, because we've still got Windows 7 and Windows 8 workstations in there.
Yeah, that's right. That can just run in a work group.
Yeah, but again, not, let's say that there are third-party apps that require NTLM authentication. We need to keep that domain. So we'll come to some of the domain challenges, but let's just, you know, again, this is...
That's what I mean. Like, if you get to that point, if you move all the SaaS off, if you do the AD Connect, as I said, like on-prem, and then you get that point where there's, like, requirements for legacy applications, yeah, sure. I mean, and then you can do your VPN and... And if you require that special authentication for those apps, what you could essentially do as well is stick your domain controller, if the requirement calls for it, is have a domain controller set up in that VNet in Azure.
And that's exactly so the legacy. And that's the next thing I was coming to, which we'll probably round off for this episode and come back to it. But let's say now we've got a member server connected, virtual member server in Azure, site-to-site VPN to on-prem environment. It's doing our Azure AD Connect. It's doing backup. It's doing whatever it else wants in the cloud. Now, we would probably, again, give us maximum flexibility and keep it clean, is we would run up another server in the VNet in Azure. We would add that to the domain as a member server, and then we would make that a domain controller. Now, to finish up with, here's a question for you, Mark. If you wanted to run up a domain controller in Azure, would you swing the existing domain onto that? So let's say you swing the domain to a new domain controller in the same domain, or would you start a new, completely new domain controller in a new forest and start it fresh? What would your thinking there? Would you swing the domain, the old domain, across to a new domain controller in Azure, or would you start a completely new clean domain on a new box in Azure? What's your thoughts there?
Generally, you'd basically a new domain controller in the existing domain, unless you've got problems with it and there's errors and whatever else and you need a new domain for some reason. Based on whatever they require.
Okay.
So let me. But generally, you just put it in the same domain.
All right. So let me throw this in at you, right? Most traditional on-prem environments, and typically SBS, are domain.local. They're not routable domains, right? So if you swung the domain across, you would be retaining a .local domain rather than a .com or .net, okay. Right?
That's okay. That's a fully qualified domain name internal. Yeah.
Correct. But again, just going forward, is it better to do it? Because Microsoft's best practice these days is to have a routable domain. Do you take this opportunity?
It'll work. It'll still work. It doesn't matter. Look, the best practice is there for a reason, is because if you have a public routable domain as your fully qualified domain name, it means that all your user accounts will have, say, rob@suchandsuch.com. Means when you move to the cloud, it's going to be easy. So that's your sign-in address. It's your email address. Look, that's why they invented UPNs, for that reason. You can create a user principal name, which sits on top of that. And so you basically set everyone's user account as the public routable domain anyway. So having a...
Yeah, correct. And you would have done that when you did the Azure AD Connect. But again, let's think about this, right? The other side I'll throw into you, besides it being .local, and maybe you want to change it to .com or .net to again, keep it consistent with you know, the current best practice, the old AD is going to have a lot of guff in it. It's going to have a lot of .local. It's going to have, don't forget, it's also going to have the schema for Exchange Server, which you aren't going to use anymore. It's potentially going to have this schema for SQL and all this sort of stuff. Do you want to bring that whole domain across?
That's all right. That's fine. I mean, the scheme is nothing, but as long as it still works, because the domain itself, I mean, yeah, sure, it's got the guff in it and the schema, but if it's not being called upon, it's not going to create any problems. But the most important part is the SIDs and the workstation IDs, which are registered in the domain, and the user accounts. If you start removing or building a new domain, then a whole bunch of these old machines which are connected to the domain, the machine itself, if the user logs in to a new domain, you're going to have to do the whole domain transformation of the profile, the user profile translation. So then you're going to look at a whole new AD migration, which is a pain in the backside.
Yeah, so I think this is an interesting conversation. In my personal preference, I think given the environment relatively small, would be to start a completely new clean domain from scratch, and you've got a known starting point. To swing across the domain, yes, you can do it, and as Mark says, it will work, and it will work well. We won't generally have any issues, but my feeling is, in talking to people that I know in this area, they recommend that you're better off starting with a new clean domain, going through that pain of rejoining, doing all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, okay, let me throw this at you. Say you had 30 machines on the network, mm-hmm. right? And then you have a brand new domain.
Yep.
Then all those 30 machines, you can't just add them to the new domain, because correct. The user then logs onto the new domain control. The user logs onto the new domain on their computer, and then all of a sudden their Windows profile looks completely different. It's the default user profile. They don't get their old profile, so they don't see all their shortcuts in the desktop.
Something to consider, but there are third-party migration tools that will bring profiles across and do that sort of stuff. Again, something that you've got to think about. And I'm not saying one is better than the other.
But it gets more than that. And then you've got to look at security. Then you've got to set up like a trust between the two domains, and then you've got to basically do the SID trust. So you've got to extend the source domain SID onto the target SID. This is going back, by the way. So you've got to look at the SID. And so not only that, you've got to look at the resources that users have access to with their local groups or global groups and stuff.
I'm not saying it's easy, but I think the other side of the coin is typically the way that people have done on-prem migrations is generally they put in a new box and they start a new domain. They don't generally swing the domain across, right? Again, this is just general.
It's really hard to get it right. Trust me, I've done this before. Like, if you put a new domain in, there's always going to be some user that's going to whinge and scream. It's like,
of course,
my computer's not working. But, and then all of a sudden, they'll whinge to the manager and say, well, you know what? You did it. The IT person gets the blame. It's just one of the hardest things to get 100% right.
I think on the other side is again, for me, I'd rather start with something clean, because I don't want to get issues down the track or some restriction because I've brought across a .local or an old domain. So the other thing I wouldn't worry
about the .local and all that sort of stuff.
So again, there are two valid options here, and I think there are arguments for both. It's really up to you as long as you get a process. The other thing I would mm-hmm. suggest that you run on the local box is IDFix. Have you heard of IDFix, Mark?
Yeah. I just do that manually.
Yeah, so basically what IDFix is, a free tool from Microsoft, will go out and check your AD, make sure it's in good health, make sure there's no orphan objects.
Or you can use PowerShell.
Again, and it will allow you to fix that. So again, run IDFix. But I think that, again, the way that we'll do this, and again, we'll round off here, is that we will put in a new domain controller. We will take Mark's approach and we will swing the domain across, the .local domain across onto this new domain controller. That will retain all the SIDs, the securities, and all that sort of stuff. So I think we'll pause it there and we'll come back and have a think about it, continue on with the migration on an upcoming episode. And again, we'll leverage Mark's expert to give you some opinions, some different angles on what's good and what's bad. But again, it's not necessarily a straightforward process, something you've got to think about, and there are a number of options. So Mark, I think that we need to let ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get back to their day. We thank them very much for listening. How yes. can they get in contact with you and the podcast?
Okay, so me, it's at Mark Keane, which is M-A-R-C-K-E-A-N. And then the podcast is at N2K Podcast. And if you got any feedback, it's the email address that you use for that, which is feedback@needtoknow.cloud.
Excellent. All right, well, you can reach me at DirectorCIA on Twitter. We also are on Facebook. Appreciate people taking the time to listen. Also appreciate if you go in and give us a bit of a review and obviously spread the word about this podcast. If you've got any topics that you'd like us to discuss in depth, please send them along to Mark and myself. But with that, I think we might let Mark get back to his icicle environment, get back to work. Nothing else from you, Mark?
Nope.
Easy. All right. Well, again, we'll thank everybody for listening to this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.